The topic for our discussion today is the Christian and materialism. The word materialism is used in a variety of ways. Philosophically, it can be used to mean that body of teaching or that searching for gratification through simply a physical universe. Schacht Herzog uses the term or defines the term in the following manner. By the term materialism is usually meant the metaphysical view that the basis of everything that exists is matter, or that nothing except matter does exist. There are a number of world religions that are materialistic by nature. And by materialistic, we mean that their sole purpose, aim, and goal in life is bound up in the physical universe. This particular series that we're having this week, and I think one of the finest that we've ever had, I wonder if the fellow backstage could cut us down on volume just a little bit. I'm having trouble here. Thank you, sir, if he will. The particular series of lessons that we've been having during the course of the week have dealt with the Christian faith and modern thought. Materialism could be considered as one of these particular areas. But if I were to try to discuss the idea of materialism this morning, I would be met with a variety of problems. One of the problems is this. The word materialism, used philosophically, conveys the idea that there is nothing to life except the material world about us. It expresses itself in intellectualism, but we've had a talk on that. It expresses itself in secularism and humanism. Brother Moss didn't leave much to be said about that. Then there is a shade of distinction that might be made in what is called materialism per se. But usually it's used as the general term to refer to the whole group of things. But materialism as a religious or a philosophical metaphysical view is best demonstrated today by what we know as world communism. But Brother Adams didn't leave a thing to be said about world communism. So we're not talking today about materialism in its philosophic or metaphysical sense. There's another use of the word materialism. It's used to describe some of those branches of so-called Christianity that have as a goal what could be called a material heaven or a material type of heaven. Those of you familiar with the sects about us will recognize the Jehovah Witness groups, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, better known as the Mormon group, as expressions of these. I remember hearing Brother Jim Miller tell of a conversation that he had with the man who is regional director or bishop of the Latter-day Saints group in this entire area. His office is up in Jacksonville. Brother Miller had a discussion with him a few years back, and the question of the nature of heaven was discussed. When they got through, the man's view had boiled down to this, that heaven for him was going to be the giving to him of some of the physical things of life that he was looking at now and desiring. Brother Miller pinned him down with the question, or Brother Miller asked him the question, how many wives are you going to have? The man said he was going to have four. He said, do you know these women? He said, yes, I know them. And then Brother Miller ventured out on a limb, as he normally does, but he's usually got a good strong one when he goes out. He said, I'll bet you that the four women that are going to be your wives in heaven are now married to brethren in your church, and none of them married you. The man said, that's right. Now, this is another form of materialism. The so-called sects of Christianity that hold the eternal life as nothing more than a newer that is physical by nature and a giving of vent to the physical desires of this life. This, again, is a possible area for a discussion of materialism, but it is not the theme of our discussion today. I want to talk about materialism in, I suppose, the simplest, and yet I believe, the most devastating use that it's employed in today. And that is materialism in the sense that Satan uses the physical world about us as an appeal to you and me to keep us from serving God. Oh, somebody says that's not much different from what's been done before. I don't care. Satan doesn't change a lot. And frankly, brethren, I'm not too concerned with just making an impression with what I talk about here this morning. I believe that the greatest problem that we face today is not institutionalism, is not world communism, but it is the matter of the material world about us holding too much of an appeal for us to spend even an hour a day in the service or contemplation of the God of heaven. Don't misunderstand. I have thrilled with you at the marvelous lectures and discussions that have been held during the week. And we ought to arm ourselves with a knowledge of all of these various appeals that are used by the world and the fight that the faith must render today. But brethren, I am not about to become a communist. I don't know if you are or not. I doubt that you are. A lot of people are, and we ought to be armed against it. But Satan doesn't have to make a communist out of him in order to win the battle. All he's got to do is dangle a few jingles and baubles in front of me enough to keep my affection off of the things above and keep me concerned with the physical things of this life, and he's won the battle. And what I say this morning is not going to be very impressive, I'm sure. And it may not be too new. I hope it's not. I'm not like the fellow that I heard about just recently. Well, I heard of him a few months back. Made a talk at one of our school lectureships just a year ago. And he was speaking on the subject of the blood of Christ. Perhaps some of you even heard this man speak. He was speaking on the subject of the blood of Christ. And during the discussion, he made this explanation. The reason that God raised Jesus' body from the grave was that when he hung on the cross, all of the blood did not drain out of his body. And since Jesus was to present his blood as a sacrifice to God, it was necessary for the physical body to be raised in order that all that blood could be presented as the atoning sacrifice. When he got through, someone asked him, "Where'd you get that idea?" And the fellow said, "Well, I've heard people talk about the blood of Christ all my life. I wanted to say something different. I wanted something new. I didn't want to just give the same old humdrum things that everybody else had." Well, brethren, I'm not concerned about that. It doesn't scare me to talk about things that have been talked about before, or to deal with points that have been dealt with before. The only problem that faces me is this, that I feel that there are so many here who could do a better job. But the task is mine. Let's proceed as we can. Materialism. The things, quote, of this world, used by Satan to keep my attention and my affection and my service from being placed in the hands of God. This is what we're talking about in the subject of materialism. God appeals to man. Unlike the Calvinistic doctrine, he does not force his will upon any of us, but he does appeal to us. God uses a variety of appeals to try to get me into his service. There is what is considered by some the lower or baser appeal of fear. God warns me, either you'll serve me or you'll go to hell. Heard some fellow say that when the modernist gets through with hell, he's got one corner of it air conditioned. Well, I don't think that's the way the Bible presents it. God tells us and describes it in awful, terrible words as a place that burns with fire and brimstone, where the worm does not die and where there's nothing but anguish and pain. And he says, unless you serve me, that's where you'll go. God appeals to us on the ground of fear, a fear of hell. But there are other kinds of appeals made. There's a greater appeal made. There's the appeal of love. John says, we love him because he first loved us. God so loved the world, we ought to love him in return. Perfect love casteth out fear. I think that the man who truly imbibes the Spirit of Christ will get to the point that he is willing and ready to serve God even if the fear factor were removed. You want to put yourself to the test? I shudder at the conclusions that I reach with regard to some of my own experiences when this question is asked personally. You go to church Sunday mornings, don't you? You give of your means. You're interested in knowing more about the Word of God. You're wanting to go to heaven. Of course, there are times that there's an extra good television program on that you'd like to stay home, perhaps, but you go on to church anyway. Let me ask you. You really thought that God wouldn't care or that God would not punish you. If you really were not afraid of going to hell as a consequence, would you still serve God? Would you give as liberally as you do give now if you thought that you could go to heaven anyway? If you honestly felt that you could cut your contribution in half and still go to heaven, would you do it? Now raise again the question, is God appealing to us in fear or in love? If we've reached that desirable point that John alludes to, perfect love casting out fear, we'd be willing to give money, time, service, energy. We'd give it all, even if there were no hell. We'd give it all because of what God has given us. God appeals to us by a variety of means. The adversary, Satan, is not a novice in this game. He, too, uses a variety of appeals. He knows that there are a lot of people who are not concerned with having a big yacht or living in the finest hotel, so he doesn't offer a yacht and a hotel to everybody. He meets the man on the grounds that the man desires. All of the appeals of Satan can be summed up in the statement that John made when he talked about love, not the world. A familiar passage, oh yes. You've used it, and I hope we'll use it more and more. John says, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the vainglory of life is not of the Father, but of the world. This is our subject today, materialism. The things of this world, as used by Satan to keep our attention, to keep our love, to keep our affection off of the God of heaven and out of His service. Let's look for just a moment at the context of this passage. We might say, by introduction to it, that all of John's writings are characterized by a conflict. You know, of course, that there is a conflict going on now. The conflict, the initial or finally, comes back to the initial conflict between God and Satan. In the gospel that John wrote, conflict is supreme. The fight there is between Jesus Christ and the power of Satan. The conflict is immediately between Jesus, the Son of God, and Satan. When you read the Revelation letter also authored by John, again we have the picture of conflict. Only now it's the conflict between the church, Christ's body, and the powers of Satan, the beast of the field, the beast of the sea, or of the earth, and the sea. And the false heart. The conflict raged. In the epistles of John, again there is conflict. There was the conflict between the truth and the Antichrist. John lived, it seems, on the conflict that was going on, and all of his books reflect that conflict. But in every one of his books there is the answer that truth will reign supreme. In the gospel, the fight was waged between Christ and the devil, and it seemed when he hung on the cross that the devil had won. And if the book had closed there, that would have been the conclusion. But he was raised from the dead. The grave was not the victory. And the book closes in the great triumph of Christ over Satan. The Revelation letter portrays the battle against the Lord's church. It shows that every power conceivable to man is employed. Political powers, false religions, and the corruptions of the world are employed to fight against the Lord's church. And seemingly there will be times when truth is dead in the street. But in Revelation 17, John reaches a climax when he said, "These shall make war against the Lamb. But he shall overcome, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings." And here's something to pin our hopes on. "And they shall overcome that are with him, the called, the chosen, and the faithful." Conflict, yes. But where is the ultimate victory? Not in the material, transient, passing things of this life, but in the things of God. A man has two choices for his affection. His affection can either be placed upon the material goods of this world, or they can be placed upon the things above. The improper object of man's affection would be anything of this world's goods. The Hebrew account gives a commendation to Moses because he chose to suffer affliction with the people of God rather to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. It'd be a fool that says that the worldly goods do not give some pleasure. But let's underscore the point that it's a seasonal joy. It'll only last a short time. And the ultimate victory lies in those who are the servants of God. The proper affection for our wills, for our hearts, would be God and His will. Oh no, it's not enough just to say, "I love God." "Not everyone that says, 'Lord, Lord,' but he that doeth the will of my Father," Jesus said. Now in the context in 1 John 2, John makes a number of references to age groups. He talks about little children, though he was particularly given to the use of that terminology. And I believe that he uses the term little children to refer to all of those who were children of God through Christ Jesus, and particularly to those on whom he had had influence as a gospel preacher and as an apostle. But in the paragraph from verse 12 through 17, John makes another reference to age. "I write unto you fathers," verse 13, "because you know him who is from the beginning. I write unto you young men, because you have overcome the evil one. I have written unto you little children, because you know the Father. I have written unto you fathers, because you know him who is from the beginning. I have written unto you young men, because you are strong in the word of God, and the word of God abideth in you, and you have overcome the evil one." Then he enumerates the powers by which Satan appeals to man. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. As I've said in the outline, the list of the worldly appeals could, that's underscored, could reflect a progression which parallels the various ages of men. I know that you cannot exclusively limit them to this point, and we'll cover that later. But it might be that John is listing these things or enumerating these appeals in this order, in a parallel to the development of man in age. Look at it. The lust of the flesh, the burning desire to satisfy or gratify the desires of the body. If I'm any judge of it, and I would be an incompetent one, I guess. But it seems that that desire burns strongest in the young people. That the physical gratification of fleshly lust is strongest among those who are young. The next would be the lust of the eye. The things that are seen, that are demonstrated through sight. The physical possessions of the world. Money, land, physical possessions that you can put up or tally up on a ledger account of some kind. Seems to burn stronger in the mind of the man who is along in the middle age of life. Or certainly the one who is trying to build his home and develop his fortune. And then John enumerates the pride or the vainglory of life. As I have said, these cannot be limited exclusively to these age groups. But certainly I do know this from observation, that the desire for worldly honor, that the desire for esteem is not quenched simply because a man's hair turns gray. As a matter of fact, all the evidence that I can see leads to a conclusion that maybe when a man gets in what we sometimes call his dotage, that he becomes particularly desirous of having people look at him and pat him on the back. We'll comment more about these in just a moment. But it seems perhaps from the context, we know that John is recognizing various age groups. Perhaps these are enumerated in line with their progression with our ages. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. However, we know that these cannot be limited just to those age groups, because it's possible for all three of these appeals to be used on the same person at the same time. In the garden, the appeal of Satan to Eve. It's good for food. It's beautiful to look upon or desirous to look upon. It'll make you as wise as God. All three of the appeals are used to the same person. When Satan took Jesus to be tempted, all three of the appeals are employed again according to the accounts in Matthew 4 and Luke 4. He offered Jesus everything in the physical creation. All three appeals. Make the stones turn into bread. Satisfy your physical hunger. Here is the lust of the flesh. Then he took him up on the pinnacle and showed him the possessions of the world, or upon the mountain and showed him the possessions of the world. I'll give them to you. Then the third, he tested him with his pride. Cast yourself down from the temple. Prove that you're able to do these things. Doesn't the scripture say that he'll send a legion of angels to protect you? Kind of like the old game the boys used to do, you know, draw the line and dare one another to step across it. Once you draw the line, there's a compulsion for me to step across. Satan was using the same kind of thing, an appeal to pride on Jesus. Prove that this is true. You make the claim, you back up the claim, now prove that it's true. Had he proved it, it would simply have been a matter of exercising his own pride. So all three of the appeals can be used at any one age in life. But it seems that they do burn stronger in those particular ages. Now, hurriedly, let's look briefly at some of these appeals. The lust of the flesh. A desire for physical gratification. Desire is not wrong. Even strong desire is not wrong within itself. When God made the world, He placed within man and within woman the fleshly desires that you and I experience today. But with every physical desire, God gave a legitimate course or a legitimate means of gratification of that desire. Now, it's not wrong to have a desire, but the Bible condemns the lust of the flesh. What distinction is to be made between a desire and what is called a lust? Someone has said that lust becomes sin when it becomes law. A lust is an inordinate desire for that which is forbidden or illegitimate or unscriptural. A man's lust is when his desire has become so strong that he wishes to gratify it even contrary to the will of God. You might walk into the bank and cash your $5 check if you're like I am, and they look twice at mine even when it's written for that amount. But you're cashing your $5 check and you look back at the teller's cage there and here's this big stack of $10 and $20 bills. You may have a desire for those things, but would you reach through and steal them if you had the opportunity? There's a difference in a desire for things and a lust that would prompt you to take it even unscripturally if you could. Jesus did not condemn the man who desires a woman. The fleshly desire of sex is a normal thing. But he cursed the man who looketh upon a woman to lust after her. This lust of the flesh can lead to a variety of open aggressions or sins against the will of God. Genesis 19. The men of Sodom, pictured so basely in the Word of God. Is that limited to an account like that? 2 days ago in the Tampa Tribune, there was a picture of over 100 men, mostly young men, in the local stockade that had been caught in a orgy of crimes against nature. Over 100 men, most of them teenagers, from our own community. The lust of the flesh. Esau, called by the Hebrew writer a profane person. A profane one is one who is not a sacred man. One whose affection is set on the worldly things, the physical things. Esau is called a profane man. And it demonstrated itself how? He was willing to surrender his birthright for a mess of pottage. The lust of the flesh. The desire for the gratifications of the things of this world in Genesis 6. Just before God destroyed the world by the flood, he described man that his affection, or that the thought of his mind was continually upon that which was evil. I'm not in position to act as God and say that the thoughts of men today are continually upon that which is evil, but I can say this, and you can too, that too many of us do live that way. And there are multiplied thousands of appeals made to us to keep our minds on that which is physical rather than that which is spiritual. How could we illustrate it? So many, many different ways. I tore a thing out of the paper last night. I'm not trying to defend the movies, but just letting them condemn themselves. Tore this out of the Tampa Tribune, where a movie mogul of one kind or another was making a talk to a group here in Tampa, urging that the movies clean themselves up before the federal government had to step in and do the job for them. I don't know how many people do go to the movies today. Since television has become as popular as it has, I don't know whether the figure is stronger or greater or not. A few years ago, there was an estimate of about 90 million people paid the ticket office each week. And of that 90 million people, over one-third were under the age of 20. Now, one other point. In thinking about this subject, I opened the Tampa Tribune a few days ago. And of 5 movies playing in the downtown houses, 3 of them had this note on them, for adults only. They were so wicked, so corrupt, and so suggestive by nature, that they placed it upon them themselves. This is not intended for the teenager. And yet over a third of the people who attend the movies, this was before the strong heyday of television, over a third of the people who were attending the movies were under the age of 20. All you need to do is look at the list of best-selling books today and ask the question, how many of them make the best-selling list on literary achievement? And how many because it's a picture of sordid life? You can drive up the road a couple of miles and find two $20 million industries. Each of them producing about 1 million barrels of beer annually. And how much liquor is being produced in this country? In 1959, I don't have the figures for 60. This is in the 61 World Almanac, but it didn't have it for 60. According to the World Almanac of this year, in 1959, there were over 90 million barrels of beer produced in the United States. Let me tell you, neighbor, if you stood with a continuing line of beer barrels coming along, and that's about 40 gallons per barrel. If you turn one of those barrels over every second, not for an 8-hour day, but 24 hours a day, if you turned a barrel of beer over and dumped it out every second of every day in the entire year, when you got through dumping those over, there would have been two more that you didn't get to. I mean, twice that many. For every one you dumped over there, two produced that you didn't get to. You'd have to be dumping over 3 barrels per second every day and every night throughout the year, Sundays, holidays, and all, to keep up with the production in this country. That's just the beer. That doesn't count the 754 million gallons of distilled liquors. I don't know if the thought of man is continually upon that which is evil. I don't know who could determine that but God. But when you look at the books that are popular, the movies that are popular, the types of advertising that are employed by our nation, and the consumption of alcohol and the money that's spent in gambling, it's rather astounding, to say the least. The lust of the flesh, this is the thing that I'm worried about for my boy and girl that are growing up now. What about you? Then there's the lust that John calls the lust of the eye. The lust for material goods, possessions, the things about us. These two constitute a source for all kinds of evil. Material possessions. A big bank account. Cattle on 1,000 hills. Keep up with the Joneses. How many of these things are the motivating factors in human lives rather than the will of God? A desire for physical goods has been an evident contributor to all kinds of wrongdoing. Take, for example, in 1 Kings 21, Ahab didn't mind murdering Naboth to get the vineyard. It seemed like a legitimate thing to want the vineyard. That's all it takes. I mean, now, after all, Naboth might have been a pretty good fellow, but why he's stupid? He won't sell the vineyard. It's his fault. Because my hunger for the physical things gets too strong for me to stand it. Joshua 7. Achan just had to have the wedge of gold, shekels of silver, the Babylonian garment. Who will know? God knew. A desire for physical goods. 2 Kings 5. Gehazi saw Elisha passing up a wonderful opportunity for possession. I mean, after all, Naaman could afford it. He had plenty of this world's goods, and He was willing to give. It's not like you're bribing the fellow to do something against his will. He's willing to spend it. My comment in passing regarding old Gehazi. His name may sound like a worker of the devil, but Gehazi was the servant of the prophet of God. He was one of these religious folks, you know. I mean, he went to church on Sunday morning. And he had an opportunity to pick up a few garments on the side, he decided. So why not? Oh, suppose I do have to lie about it a little. He's willing to give it. And Elisha was too big a fool to take it. So I'll get it. Luke 12, the selfishness of the rich man. All he was concerned with was the physical goods that he could get his hands on. So the heretic up made a point that I want to employ, but not without giving him credit. He preaches a sermon that he calls The Evolution of a Rich Man. And he says, and I would say with him, that I don't know that he's talking about the same fellow, but just look at these three rich people that are described in the teaching of Jesus. The rich young man, Jesus said, sell what you have, give it to the poor. Wouldn't do it. He desired the physical possession. He refused to give them up. Then the rich man of Luke 12 tore down his barns, built new barns, all this. Eat, drink, be merry. You've got it made. Then in Luke 16, the rich man lifting up his eyes in torment. What's wrong with physical possession? In and of themselves, nothing. Not money that's the root of all evil, as the old song said. It's the love of money, as the Lord said. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. God's placed us here with certain desires, and in order to satisfy these, there have to be some physical things provided. Food is physical. The desire for food is not an illegitimate or should not be an inordinate desire. But desires of this kind and desires for possessions of the world can get the better of a man. I'm not convinced that we ought to be blind to the physical things about us. You hear about the little nigger boys that were sitting on the curb one day and the Catholic priest walked along and said, how you boys did? A fine father, they all said. Looked down and said, you boys want to go to heaven? Most of them. One of the boys said, no. Priest looked at him and said, you don't want to go to heaven, boy? No, sir. He says, boy, you don't want to go to heaven when you die? Oh, yes, sir. He says, I want to go to heaven when I die. He says, I thought you was getting up a load right now. There's nothing wrong in a man enjoying the things of the world. Now, God's placed them here for our enjoyment. He's placed them here for our use. But the wrong comes when the man is totally unconcerned about going to heaven. All he's concerned about is in the gaining of physical possessions today. I couldn't go to church Sunday. Why? I had to work. I've had that said to me several times. Since I do some preaching, it's said to me, I guess, more than it would be to somebody that doesn't preach. And occasionally it is somebody whose back is right to the wall, who's on the verge of starvation, that's out here working on a Lord's Day. But just if you'll grant me a generalization out of my short past, not too short, I have to guess. I'd say that 99.44% of those who have said to me, I had to work. They're not the fellows who are hungry and whose kids don't have shoes and who have inadequate clothing, but the guy with one big bank account that wants a bigger one. You stop and look about you. Who is it that misses church on Sunday morning? Is it the guy that's hungry or is it the guy that's already well fed but he's greedy? Who is it that can't afford to take off from his job and go to work? I've found it very seldom to be the guy that's really on the wall. The lust of the flesh. The lust of the eye. The desire for those physical possessions about us. Then, John says, the pride of life. Doddridge defines the pride of life as this. The phrase refers to that ambitious turn of mind which prompts men to engage in all those pursuits which will supply materials for their vanity and enable them to make a figure in the world. A desire for praise by men. A pat on the back. Preach it round or flat. Just as long as you pat me on the back. Jesus condemned people for standing on the street corner and praying long prayers just to be heard of men. Well, he said they get their reward, they get it now. They better enjoy it now, too. When somebody comes along and says, isn't he a fine fellow, look how long he prays, he says, that's his reward. Or the man that toots his horn to call a crowd and then makes his contribution to those who are poor, he said he gets his reward. People seeing what the man has given, that's it. And the honor that comes to him. Ananias and Sapphira couldn't stand to pass up the opportunity to have folks pat them on the back. They had seen the honor that had come from other men to Barnabas. And probably others like Barnabas. They were greedy enough that they wouldn't give all, and they didn't have to give it, of course, you realize that. But they wanted the praise of men. Paul says, if I'm seeking the praise of men, I'm no longer a servant of God. King Saul fell into the acts of God because he was more concerned about the honor and esteem from the world than from God. The cry ringing in his ear, Saul has slain his thousands, David his tens of thousands, just goaded him to the point he couldn't stand. In other words, when you come around to hear me preach, don't stand up and brag on somebody else. I want you to brag on me! No. You know the point. A desire for the honor of the world. The man that I referred to in the introduction, who wanted to preach something new, was terribly concerned that he wouldn't make an impression on the people who heard him. Boy that I went to school with in ACC, who did graduate work up here at Florida State, Tallahassee, preached for a little rural congregation in North Florida, one that I preached for, son. One of the elders there told me this. This boy got to using this big, long 4-bit and 6-bit words and even Latin expressions, and only one person in this whole congregation had ever been inside of a college door. And that was a little school teacher in town. The rest of them had an average of about a second grade education. And this fella kept coming out with these big long words. So the elders went to him in a group one day and they begged him and said, make your sermons where we can understand it. His reply to them was this, what you have in education if you're not going to use it? What was he concerned with? I'll tell you what he was concerned with, brethren. When people walked out the back door, he wasn't concerned with whether they went out that door convinced that they wanted to do better in God's sight. He wanted them to walk out the door and say, wasn't that a beautiful sermon or wasn't that a magnificent lecture? Oh, yes. Preachers can fall into this condemnation. I heard a man who is a prince of preachers, so to speak, say to a group of us young boys in his class, one of our schools, learn to memorize these names. Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, this was the example that he used. And down the list of the kings, or of the judges he went, then he said, when you stand up in a pulpit and you say that, said the brethren will say, boy, he knows what he's talking about. He's got the reputation for it, too. A concern for the esteem, the honor, the praise of men. If I were seeking the praise of men, I would not be a pleaser of God, Paul said. How do we get away from it? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, pride. Is there an answer? Of course there is.
Of course there is. These are not all the answers, but I just suggest briefly one or two in closing. First, realize the true comparative values. Sure, the world offers pleasure, joy, rewards, but it's only for a season. Jesus said, "What's it profit a man to gain the whole world, lose his soul?" The entire world is not worth your soul. The physical ought to be subordinated to the spiritual. The physical things of this life are not as important as the spiritual. Self-control is demanded. The bringing of one's body in subjection. Paul used the illustration of a runner. He exercises self-control in all things. He said, "I buffet my body, bring it into subjection, lest after I've preached to others, I myself should be a castaway." The summation and the key to the whole problem is this. For me to set my mind, which is my heart, my affections, on the things above and not to be so concerned with the physical things of this life. What difference does it make, brethren, if I don't have as much money as everybody else in the world? What difference should it make to us as a church? Let me rephrase it. What difference should it make to us as the church if we don't have a national television program as big as somebody else has? What difference should it make? And is it such a shame and a disgrace? I know there's another extreme to this, but I'm not concerned with that one right now, and you see the point. Is it such a shame and a disgrace when some denominational group in town builds a bigger edifice than we do? Why aren't we equally concerned with running competition with the state houses? With the entertainment world? Well, no, we say we're in a different business than they are. Well, Brendan, I want to tell you. The church that I'm a member of is in a different business than the denominational world is. They're in the social business. And I hope I'm not. My affection must be set upon the things of God if I'm going to be pleasing to Him. Satan relies on the old proverb, "A bird in the hand, better than two in the bush." Enjoy yourself now, eat, drink, be merry. Don't worry about out there. The Christian's hope is not in the hand. The Christian's hope is in the world beyond. Paul says we walk by faith, not by sight. In closing, I want to tell you a story from Greek mythology. Not to impress you, but in hopes to help us to be more conscious of a devotion to God. Homer wrote the stories of Ulysses. And among the voyages of this great adventurer, the story is told about his going into one of the areas around the Grecian Isle. And there was a very treacherous passage through which the ships must sail. There were great rocks on either side of the small channel or the narrow channel. And on the banks of the little islands there were beautiful women known as sirens. And these sirens stood on the shores of these little islands and sang beautiful, alluring songs to the sailors. And according to Homer's mythological story, the sailors would be overcome with the beauty and they would sail their ships toward it. They would break up on the rocks and perish. Occasionally some would, if the ship weren't going in that direction, he'd jump overboard and try to swim to the island only to be lost in the sea. Ulysses was on such a journey. There were two ships in his group. He was the captain of the first. When they neared the isle and the dangerous passageway, he instructed his sailors to pour hot wax into their ears and completely seal their ears so that they could not hear. Then they were to bind him to the mast and leave his ears open, but tie him securely to the mast.
Then he told them to roll furiously and definitely past the dangerous rocks. So they bound him. Their ears were stopped and they rowed through. But Ulysses could hear the noise. He heard the alluring sound. He struggled to break away. He tried his best to break the bonds in order that he could jump overboard. He desired to get away. He called to the men, begged with them, pleaded with them, "Release me, release me." But they couldn't hear him. He made it through. Only because he was forced to stay on the ship. In the ship that followed behind, the captain used another device. He had on board a man named Orpheus, reputed as the sweetest singer of antiquity. He had Orpheus sit on the bow of the ship and sing. And the song that was sung by Orpheus was so beautiful and so much more alluring and satisfying than the songs that came from the siren on the side, that the men rode right through without any danger. Oh, they could hear it from over here. But they heard a better song, a more beautiful song. There are two ways that you can try to live a Christian life. One is under a bondage, a binding yourself and just repeating day after day, "Don't do this and don't do that." But there's a better way. And that's to hear a sweeter song, to have your heart, your mind, your affection on a better kind of life. This, I think, is what Paul meant when he said, "Set your affection on the things above, mind not the things of the world."